Well, if you have your Bible, I get you to turn to Matthew 13. I don't know if there is another passage of Scripture. I'm sure there may be. I just can't call it to mind right now. That has more interpretations than what we're going to look at tonight. Now, I'm not going to run the rabbit and chase all of what other people have said. I'm going to tell you what I think the Lord has kind of given to me. But, of course, Matthew 13 is one chapter, and it has seven what is called parables of the kingdom in it. And we're going to be looking at three verses tonight. We're going to look at 44, 45, 46. And it's one of those things where you can see it, and then all of a sudden something else will pop into your mind and you go, well, maybe that's it. And then something else, maybe that's it. And so I want us to just kind of simply try to walk through it a little bit if we can, all right? Now, how many of you have ever heard of an old preacher years ago named Russell Conwell? That's exactly what I thought. Nobody, all right? You say, why is that? Because he's not known for his preaching. He was a preacher, but he's not known for his preaching. He's known mostly for one book. The book is called Acres of Diamonds. Anybody ever read that book? Have you guys read it? I see your head shaking. Or is that just because you're so tired from Israel? All right. Have you read it? Heard of it. Okay. All right. Let me tell you about the book. Acres of Diamonds is a fictional story, but it has a great moral truth to it. It is one of these things where that you can read it, and it's such a simple read. Not a big book at all. As a matter of fact, I used to buy five or six at a time, and I would give it to different people. Sometimes I'd give it to teenagers whenever they're graduating from high school. Sometimes I'd give it to maybe some man that was trying to make a decision in his life for his family. And I would hand these books out. At one time, I found where I could get them for like $1.50 a piece. I think they're more than that now. But I was giving these things out because it had made such an impression on me as a young man. And this is a story. A man owned a piece of property, and he had visions of being wealthy. I mean, he wanted to be a rich man. And all he had was this stinking farm, and he was always trying to do something on that farm. He's got to feed the animals, and he's got to plow the fields, and he hates every bit of it. He wants to be able to be a mover and a shaker, and he's trying to think, how can I get enough money to get away from this place? And so finally, there's somebody that approaches him, and they say, would you like to sell your farm? And he was like, yes, I would. I would be happy to sell this place. So they decide on a price. The purchaser gives him the money, and the man takes that pocket full of money that he's got, and he is gone. He goes to a different land, and the last word was that he had gone through his money and that he had died as a pauper in that distant land. You come back, though, to where the farm was. This piece of land that he felt like was worthless. All it was a bunch of rocks. I mean, it was causing problems every time he tried to plow. The new owner, though, was surveying his new purchase. And he was walking the property, and as he walked the property, one of the things on the property was a stream, or we would call it a creek. And as he was walking, he thought, boy, that's awful pretty. Something was glistening and it caught his eye. And he thought, well, that's kind of strange. And so he waded out into the shallow water, and he reached down and picked it up. And he's like, That's something that's pretty nice right there. He didn't know what it was, and so he took it to a jeweler in town and said, "Can you tell me what this is?" And the jeweler got his little eyepiece out and he was looking at it, and all of a sudden he goes, "Do you realize what you have here?" And he goes, "A nice looking rock." He said, "This is a huge diamond." And the man goes, "Really?" He goes, "Yeah." So this is a diamond that is worth many thousands of dollars. And so the owner did not say anything. He just took it back. He went back to his property, went back to that stream, and as he began to really look, in the stream where he had purchased was glistenings all over the place, and it turned into one of the largest diamond finds in history. The man that previously owned it died as a pauper, and he had diamonds in his own backyard, hence acres of diamonds. One man was looking where he was at, and the other man always saw something over there. And the moral of the story that I've tried to tell young people and men that have asked my opinion on things, you need to pay attention where you're at and not think about some distant field somewhere. You know, the grass is not always greener on the other side. And so when I read that, my thought was, I like that book. There's some great truths in this book. And I think that probably that has contributed to my willingness to stay at one place for 47 years. I think that that probably is a part of it, because I think that God can do great things here just like he can do in other places. You don't have to go around the world to have God do something. The Lord can do it right where you're at. He can do it at your address where you live. He can do it in your backyard. Now, you may not find a diamond, you know, find. You know, they may not say, "Hey, let me give you millions and millions of dollars for your piece of land here." You know, and then all of a sudden, you know, you got a pocket full of money. That may not be that, but from a spiritual standpoint, you can certainly be blessed and you can be a wealthy person in your Christian life. Now, as I was reading over these parables, that book is what kept cropping up into my mind. A second thing that cropped up was, we had a man that was a part of this church eons ago. He got killed a couple of years ago just walking in his neighborhood. He was well into his 80s, walking in his neighborhood, walked every single day. Somebody came in, wasn't paying attention, and hit him, and he died. But if you go back 40 years, one of the things that Norman Malone loved to do, he loved to take his metal detector and go searching for Civil War relics. In the village of Stone Mountain 40 years ago, at one of the corners, there used to be a little, it really wasn't a museum as much as it was a souvenir place. Hub's shaking his head. He knows exactly what I'm talking about. You could go into that place. Well, the guy that was the owner was a buddy of Norman's, and Norman flew a little light plane. They would get in that plane with their metal detectors. And, you know, as one man that used to work in our sound booth years ago, he said they'd have their ear goggles, you know, and they'd have their metal detectors and their ear goggles, and they would fly up to Virginia, and they'd go through those Civil War battle sites, and they would pick up buttons that had been on, you know, a Confederate officer's coat or a Union officer's coat, and they would find bullets and they would find all kind of things, and they would come back and they would put them in those glass displays there in that souvenir place. And if you had enough money, you could buy it. They weren't doing it to try to keep it. They were doing it because they wanted to sell and make some money out of it. And so they were treasure hunters. That's what we see tonight. Look with me at verse 44. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like. Well, what is this one like? It's like unto treasure hid in a field. Now, the first thing that I want you to think about tonight is I want you to think about the places, all right? Now, when you think about a field, what's a field made of? Dirt, earth, land. Keep that in mind. I'm coming back to it. All right? And so you've got this man, and it says that he is in a field, and he finds something in this field. Now, what does he find? He finds something that was hidden. It does not tell us what it was. My guess is that it was probably some type of either wooden box, maybe made out of acacia wood, which was a very durable wood, or maybe even a piece of pottery. In Qumran, Israel, there is a bunch of caves that have been found. When this was found in 1948, there were 11 caves that were discovered. They've since discovered a few more, but they've not found anything in the newly discovered caves that they did in the first 11. But in 48, it was probably the greatest archaeological find of the 20th century. You had the Dead Sea Scrolls that were found there. That predated the earliest scriptures that they had to date. And this one predated all of those by 1,000 years. And when they compared manuscripts and all of that, there was one book in every Old Testament, or one, at least a fragment, if not a whole book, of every book in the Old Testament except Esther. That's the only one that was not there. And so it was a great find, but it was a hidden thing. And so that's the picture. Now, these people would understand that. Now, in these ancient times, how did they measure wealth? Well, we measure wealth by handing a banker maybe a financial statement. It'll talk about how much money you got in a savings account, how much money you got in a checking account, what's your car's worth, what's your truck's worth, what kind of property you have, what type of investments you got. And you'll have all of that listed on a piece of paper, and they'll check it out to see if it's legit or if you're lying. And then you can do business depending really on your net worth. They'll find out how much you owe, how much you have, and then they'll make a decision on it. These ancient times, it was not quite that easy because they didn't have banks. They had money lenders, but they weren't FDIC insured. You had had people, and how did they determine their wealth? Well, usually they would look and say, well, how much land does that man own? Well, he's got a lot. He must be wealthy. Look at all the livestock he's got. He got a bunch of them. He must be wealthy. But one of the ways that people would hide their wealth is they would take gold or jewels, and they would put them in containers, and they would bury them in the field. Now, they may have some type of triangulation where they would say, now, this tree and this tree, when you pull together this much, that's where this is buried. I mean, they had a treasure map in their minds, at least, where this was buried. You say, well, why didn't they just keep it in the house under the mattress? Because that's exactly where a marauder is going to look. Do you remember when we went through Judges a few years back? How many times the Philistines would wait for Israel to plant crops, raise crops, and then when the harvest came in, they would run the farmers off and take their land or take their grain. They would take whatever they had been growing, they would take it, they'd have Israel do all the work, and then they would come in as a raiding party and run them off. And that's why you have one man, and I forget his name, but he said, you know what, I'm done running. And it was, you're not getting this pea patch. You're not getting my lentils. And he fought them because they were trying to take what he had raised. You got a picture of old Gideon. He's on that threshing floor, and he's throwing it up, and he's looking up, looking around. You know why? Because he's had them come and take his stuff before. Well, that's what would happen in these ancient times. If they knew you had gold, they come and take it. They knew you had jewels, come and take it. Now, they didn't have $100 bills that they would give to people, all right? It was either property, it was livestock, or it was something that could be put in a container and buried in the ground. Now, in our text here, most likely what has happened is that the original owner that had buried the box is dead. The people that own it right now do not know what's in the ground. Now, I've known of some people that have buried some things in the backyard, all right? Anybody ever known anybody done stuff like that? Yeah, I know some of you have, because I see you know your heads nodding, and I've never really known of a lot of people that have done that, but I've heard of people that have put money in the walls of their house. I'm talking about like behind the boards in the walls of their house, and I've also heard about some of those same houses burning down. That'd be rough. And so they would take this treasure and they put it out in the field somewhere. This guy's probably died, and now a new guy is doing some work. I don't know if it's the new owner, the new owner has hired this man. But anyway, he finds this hidden treasure. What does he do? Well, if you keep reading, it says when he found it, he hideth. In other words, he digs, shovel hits something. He goes, oh, that doesn't sound right. He looks around and goes, that's a box. Maybe he peeks in the box and goes, I got to put this back in the ground. So he puts it back in the ground. He kind of learns markers. He triangulates. He does whatever he needs to, because he knows he's coming back one day. And so, for joy he therefore goeth and selleth all that he has and buyeth that field. So in other words, he doesn't tell a single soul about what he's known. Now, we know that the original owner died because the original owner would have known about what was hidden in the field. But this man has found it. Nobody else knows about it. He knew about the diamonds that somebody else didn't know about. So what does he do? He's just a common laborer. He goes. He begins to sell off any type of property that he's got. When I say property, I'm talking about like clothes. I'm talking about tools. I'm talking about any type of livestock. He's doing everything he can to try to get this money together. Why? Because he's got one goal in mind. I want that piece of property. Now, it doesn't say that he's trying to buy the treasure. No, he's got to buy the property so that he can have access to the treasure. And so we see that the first place is the field. Now, I think that the interpretation of this field here, I really believe that that treasure that's in that field, I believe it's the nation of Israel. You say, why do you believe that? Go to Exodus chapter 19, verse 5. Exodus 19, 5. We're also going to go to Psalm 135, 4. I hope I typed that out straight. Exodus 19, 5. Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then you shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. So from creation, we know that the earth is the Lord's. And here in Exodus, he tells the Israelites that you shall be a peculiar or a special treasure for all the people in the earth. Well, has that taken place? Yeah, it has. When you think about the nation of Israel, they were the least of all the people. Why did God choose them? Because they were the least of all the people. And when he did something great with them, the whole world is going to understand, and we'll go to that probably in a little bit, But we will look at Genesis 12 and we will see that Abraham was walking and it was all about land. And so I want us to look at Psalm 135, verse 4. For the Lord hath chosen Jacob, which is another name for Israel, unto himself, and Israel for his peculiar treasure. And so I really believe that this is about literal land, and that the treasure in the field, which is the world. You say, well, how do you know that? Do you remember the parables that we went back to weeks and weeks ago about the sower and the seed? The sower's the Lord, and where's the places they're sowing? All over the world, all right? And so we see that the treasure is likely Israel. All right, I want you to go with me to prove that there's going to be an earthly people where the Lord sets his kingdom up. How many of you know what Isaiah 9:6 says? We were about to hear it 47 times. It's Christmas coming. Let's look at Isaiah 9:6. I mean, one of the most famous passages at Christmas time. And I want you to pay real close attention to one little phrase. For unto us a child is born, and unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. Where are governments at? They're on the earth. There's going to be the Lord, and he is going to have the government sit on his shoulder, which means that he is the boss. He's going to be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. All right? Now, I want you to go to the verse that we talked about just a second ago. Go to Genesis 12, verse 3. And I've either got to skip something or talk faster. All right? And I will bless them that bless thee, curse him that curseth thee, and in thee all shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now, that is what is called the Abrahamic covenant. It's reiterated several times during the life of Abraham. It's reiterated during the time of Isaac. It's reiterated during the time of Jacob. All those patriarchs, every single one of them, they had that land covenant that was reiterated to them. When you see that Abraham walked not just in the land of Israel that we see today, but he walked in other places, even that land geographically will ultimately belong to Israel. I mean, it's going to be a big swath of land, and it's because of what Abraham did, and he is going to sit on his throne in the capital city, which is Jerusalem. All right? It's not Washington, D.C. It's Jerusalem. And so it's about land. Now, I want us to look at the second thing tonight. I want you to look with me at verse 45. Matthew 13, verse 45. Again, the kingdom of heaven is likened to a merchantman. And what is this merchantman doing? Now, this is a businessman. This is not a common laborer. This is someone that probably is wealthy in his own right. And what is he doing? He is seeking goodly pearls. Now, how many of you have ever heard of someone that deals in pearls, digging them up in a field? Nobody. You don't get pearls from a field. You get pearls from the ocean, which is water. Symbolically in the Bible, the waters have to do with the earth's population. Now, I don't have time to run this rabbit, but you can go to Revelation and you can see that out of the waters, there's things that are going to come. One of those things that will come will be the Antichrist. And so we have a merchant man, and he is seeking goodly pearls, which means that he is getting that from the sea. In verse 46, who, when he had found one pearl, of great price. Now he's looking for pearls, plural. But all of a sudden, there is one pearl. And when he sees that, it's like, that's it. That's what I've got to go for. So what does he do? Not a common laborer, but he sells everything that he has. He takes every bit of inventory that he's got. He takes every bit of cash that he has, every one of those gold coins, every IOU from a trusted maybe merchant that he has had dealings with that has vouched for him. He's taking everything that he has gotten over his life, and he goes, I've got to have that right there. There are people that have spent hundreds of millions of dollars for one piece of memorabilia. I hear about people that have great money and they buy these things, and I'm thinking, what could you do if you would have taken that money and put that into missions? What could the kingdom of God look like instead of you getting that, you know, Picasso painting, which I never did understand Picasso. It looked to me, that was too abstract for me. But some of the stuff, you know, I often wondered about that Mona Lisa. You guys remember wonder why she didn't smile? I'm wondering if she had bad teeth. That's what I'm wondering. All right? A little sidebar there. All right? And so people spend big money on things that they desire. And so you've got the places. So the earth and the sea. I think that the sea, where that pearl that comes out of the sea, I think that's the church. See, I don't believe in what is called replacement theology. And I think that here you've got the Lord, and what is he doing with these parables? He is hiding truths from the people. Why? Because they rejected him. And so we see the places. Second of all, I want you to see the plan. Go back to 44. If you go back to 44, he is digging, and he finds something that he is not looking for. There's not a single thing in this parable that says, now he was digging because he had heard that it was there. You know, he didn't have an Indiana Jones treasure map where he could say, now if I go there, I've looked at these sources, I think if I go there, I can dig and I think I can find it. I mean, it wasn't like that, you know, there was some hidden meeting in the Declaration of Independence, you know, that Nicolas Cage and National Treasure found, all right? This man is just out there digging, but all of a sudden, boom, it happens, and he begins to formulate a plan in his mind. He's digging, he finds something, and he goes, I can't tell anybody, but my whole life just changed. One of the reasons that I don't believe that these two passages or these two parables are really the gospel or salvation is because what are these two men doing? They're working to get what they want. Well, you and I know that you don't work to get saved. You're saved by grace through faith. And that not of yourselves, not of works, lest any man should boast. It's a gift of God. And so that's why I don't believe many of the interpretations that come down the pike is because it turns it into a man-made type salvation. So just, you know, put that in your shirt pocket and chew on that for a little bit. But you have this man digging, and what is he doing? He is doing everything he can to obtain this land. How can I make this mine? I mean, he is focused on this one particular thing. All of us have had things in our minds that we have focused on. Sometimes it's been a piece of land. Sometimes it may be a piece of jewelry or some other type of item. Sometimes it could be a person. You know, when I first laid eyes on my wife, I never knew her before till I saw her at the college. I mean, I was coming off of what I would call a hard breakup with a girl, and I mean, it rocked me for about 10 months, you know, and then all of a sudden she walked by, Deb did, and I got whiplash when I looked, and I'm telling you, things got better quick. Well, what was I trying to do? I was trying to win her. I mean, I'm trying to do everything that I can to win her. I mean, I'm doing stupid stuff, you know. I mean, I'm writing notes. I'm printing them so she can read them. You know, I'm putting English leather on the envelope so she can smell them. I mean, I'm doing everything I can to try to get her to, hey, pay attention to this guy, all right? And so, ultimately, I got her. But she was a focus. When I started focusing on her, the other ones kind of went by the wayside. And when we focus on something with our whole heart, then you can have that you're going after, because nothing's going to stop you. You are going to be so like a laser beam just going right there for it. That's what these men have done. Look at verse 45 and 46. This guy has been a merchant. He's looking for goodly pearls. He doesn't really know that this one opportunity is going to come along. Oh, but when it does, he knows that things just changed in his life. Can I tell you that we can make this application for salvation? Can I tell you that when I got saved, everything changed? I was on a whole different trajectory when I got saved than I was before I got saved. Before I got saved, I had all these aspirations that I wanted to do, but when I got saved and started focusing on the Lord, all of a sudden, all of that stuff kind of fell by the wayside, and it was, what does God want? And that became the focus. That became the plan. And so you've got these men, and they see what they have never seen before, and nothing else matters after that. Go to 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 9, and I want you to see what Christ did when it came to the cross for us. In other words, he wanted salvation to be the reason he was here. Did the Bible not say that he set his face like a flint toward Jerusalem? It absolutely says that. Look at our verse. For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, he created everything, every tree, every stone, every river, every ocean, every cloud, everything is his. He's the owner. Though he was rich, yet for your sakes, talking to the people at Corinth, for your sakes, he became poor, that you, through his poverty, might be rich. In other words, he left the splendor of glory, as the old song says. He condescended and came down to earth. He lived in a very meager surrounding. Can any good thing come from Nazareth? Can any good thing come out of Galilee? No, man, a bunch of hay seeds. That's where he's at. When he got his ministry off the ground, moved to Capernaum. If he ever slept in a house, the house belonged to somebody else. Slept in Peter's house. He slept in Lazarus's house. Slept in a couple of other houses. But for the most of the time, he was sleeping rough. It's like when I preached the other day, Sunday, about the woman taken in the act of adultery. Jesus sleeps in the Mount of Olives while other people go to their homes. He had heaven. He had everything in heaven. But he laid that aside because he loved us. That's a big focus in itself. And so we see the plan from these guys. Now, before I move to the final and third thing tonight, the pleasure, let me just mention a word about eternity. The Lord gives us an opportunity because the focus that he had, the plan that he had, gives us eternal life. There's a saying that says this, eternity's long. Get it right. You think about that for a minute. If you don't get eternity right, that's a long time to be wrong. And so, everything, every decision, every focus, it has to do with there, out there. Third thing, what was the pleasure? Well, look back at verse 44. And it says, and for joy thereof he goeth and selleth all that he hath. In other words, there was something on the inside of him that rose up. And there was a joy unspeakable and full of glory when he saw that box that he had dug up and then he reburied it. Every time he thought about that, there was something where he didn't say anything to anybody. And again, that's why I don't think this is the gospel, because we're not to hide the gospel, we're to share the gospel. That makes sense? And so every time this man would think about, I know where that box is at, and there might be more. If I can ever get enough money together, if I can save everything that I've sold, and if I can earn a little bit more by working here and there, ultimately I can have the exact price that I need, and I'll do this, and I'll get that property. And then I'll be able to dig and dig, but I can for sure dig where I hit that treasure box. And so there is a joy that's there. I think that the same joy where that the man in the field was able to experience that, I think that the merchant himself, he's never seen a diamond like this. He knows there's something special about it. Now, you can equate really how a pearl is made. You can actually equate that with what the Lord Jesus Christ did at Calvary. You say, well, how do you do that? Well, are you familiar with how pearls are formed? There's usually a little tiny grain of sand. And somehow, when that oyster opens its shell, I don't know if it's to feed or whatever, but somehow maybe a current will blow some dirt from the bottom of the ocean, and a little grain of sand will get on a tender side of that oyster, and when that oyster closes its shell, the sand is still there. And it becomes an irritant. All of us have had some type of pebble or a little small sticker or something that has gotten into a boot or to a tennis shoe. And it's like, I got to get that out. I can't tell you that I've got some old boots that I use around the house. They don't even tie. They just slide in and out. But there's times when it's like, I got to take that boot off and shake that thing out. When I was a kid, I had some old cowboy boots, and my mom would always say, now you be careful putting those boots on. There might be a snake in there. And I'm thinking, what does she know? Well, one day I was out there, and all of a sudden I was going to put them boots on. Well, I kicked one of them over, and a baby snake came out of it. From then on, my mama was a smart lady. And so you've got this irritant that's inside of this little oyster shell. And what does the oyster do? That oyster begins to try to put some type of liquid that's out of its body on it to try to get rid of it. And it hardens and it hardens and it hardens. And over the life of that oyster, ultimately a pearl is formed. Now, this next statement, I put this in the same category that I do with a statement that Brother Ralph Sexton makes. You remember when I told you that Ralph says that in a pomegranate there are 613 seeds? And that stands for the 613 laws of Moses. Now, I've tried, and I lose count or I lose interest. But I have cut some pomegranates, and I've tried to count those things, and I've never done it. And so I'm kind of taking his word for it, but I'm not betting my salvation on it. Okay? Love him. I hope he's right. I kind of put this statistic here in that same category. It is said that to get one pearl, you have to open 1,000 oysters to get one pearl. That's how often you find that. Now, when I open oysters, it's usually to eat them. I like good oysters. I like them roasted mainly. And then, you know, if they're not big and gaudy, that's better. Put them on crackers with some hot sauce, pretty good something to eat. But one in 1,000 oysters, and you might find a pearl, unless somebody else is opening the oysters and you're not finding it. I was talking to Sandy Deitch yesterday, and she was telling me about what was going on with her leg and telling me about her daughter and her son, and we just kind of laughed a little bit about things that were happening and all of that. And so when I hung up the phone, I began to think about this. When she and Walt lived in Stone Mountain, Walt was a truck driver. And when he would come in, he had gotten paid, he'd have some cash in his pocket. Well, he would take some money and he would put it in a coat pocket of one of his suits that he never wore. And he would come in every payday and he'd put, you know, 50 or 100 bucks in that suit. Well, one day he comes in and the suit is gone. I mean, it's gone. And he goes, "Sandy, where's my suit?" "Well, you never wore it. I sent it to Goodwill." "Did you check the pockets?" "No, there's nothing there. I didn't go in through no pockets." Said, "I had $1,200 in that pocket." Got down there, the suit was there, but there wasn't no money in it. Well, let me tell you something. If you opened up a pearl or an oyster and there was a pearl in it, you could have the, but if you had somebody helping you out, you might not ever see that pearl. And so you've got this man, and he's got great pleasure because he now sees this one, and he's going after it. Can I tell you, there's no joy like the joy of the Lord. The joy of the Lord is my strength. That's what the psalmist tells us. And so what do we do as Christians? Well, we need to stay focused. We don't need to get unfocused. Now, I think it was Calvin that made this statement. And I'm not a big Calvin fan, but I like this statement. He said, "Our hearts are idol factories." And I think that's true. We can get so sidetracked. The devil is a master at getting us focused on something besides serving the Lord. But that's what we need to do. We don't need to be, like the old song says, prone to wander, Lord, I feel it, prone to leave the God I love. We don't need to do that. Let me give you a couple more verses and then a couple more comments and we'll be done. I want you to look with me at Luke 12, verse 33 and 34. This is what I think of when I think about the man that tried to buy the field and ultimately did, or the man that tried to buy the pearl and did. This is what I think about here. "Sell that you have and give alms. Provide yourselves bags which wax not old." That's a reference to like skins that get old and brittle and break and you lose the contents. "A treasure in the heavens that faileth not, where no thief approacheth." That's why they buried it out in the field or in the backyard, so that nobody could look underground. "Neither moth corrupt it." You take a nice Babylonian garment like the story in the book of Joshua, Achan, and you put it in the ground in some type of thing, and the next thing you know, you open it up, it's just moth-ridden. It's useless. Verse 34, "For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." So in other words, we're focused on the Lord because that's where our treasure's supposed to be. We're not supposed to just be caught up with just material things. Our focus ultimately is the Lord. Look at Colossians 3, verse 23 and 24. "And whatsoever you do, do it heartily as unto the Lord and not unto men." Verse 24, knowing that the Lord, that of the Lord you shall receive the reward of the inheritance, for you serve the Lord Christ. You will never, ever be on the losing end if you serve the Lord and sacrifice for the Lord. The Lord will never be beholden to anybody. And so, kind of piggybacking on the story of Conwell, opportunities are close by to serve the Lord and to focus on Him. You can do that at your home. You can do that in your neighborhood. You can do that in your church. Opportunities are close by. But to secure them, first of all, you've got to be looking. You've got to try to gain the knowledge of where that treasure is buried and where that pearl is at. Well, how do you do that once you gain the knowledge? You stay disciplined. The man that knew that that treasure was buried in that field, he didn't tell anybody. He kept his mouth shut. He kept the old saying, you've heard this, the nose to the grindstone. He sells everything that he owns. He works and works until he can get enough money, and then he goes, here you go. And they take care of that transaction at the city gate. And that land becomes his, and nobody knows it until he starts digging up treasure that he is now a wealthy man. And so you gain that knowledge, but then there's a discipline that goes to it, where that you stay focused and you go after it, you go after it, you go after it. And it's the same way with the merchant. He saw that and nothing else mattered. He was always looking more dominoes down the line than just the one right in front of him. It was always about that one that was out there, and all these other things were just frivolous. And so he was focused on what he was supposed to do. Matter of fact, both of them were. And so, as far as the interpretation, I think that the field and the treasure that's in the field is Israel. And I think that the great pearl, the one that's of great price, I think that's the church. And I think that both of these go together, and that God has plans for Israel and us.